On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 6 years tomorrow, 6 years since 9/11. It's getting to be a long time. Maybe now it's time to look at where we've been. If Pearl Harbor galvanized the nation in one direction, 9/11 galvanized it in many. Pro-war, anti-war, right, left, and scattered center. Politicians and pundits have analyzed how and why. Now the psychologists are stepping in and focusing on the impact of fear. Research finds the mere mention of death changes minds. Twin Towers exploding is a psychological supernova. Up next on Point, where our minds have been since 9/11. We'll hear today from two psychologists and a big-picture thinker on national security. Joining me first from Albany, New York, is Sheldon Solomon, professor of psychology at Skidmore College and the co-author of In the Wake of 9/11, The Psychology of Terror. Professor Solomon, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
We're really interested in exploring your research, and I guess the thing to say first is that it predates 9/11. You developed a deep interest in how humans' thinking changes when death is on their minds. What does that date back to for you? What got you started on this path?
Well, Tom, we've been working on this line of inquiry since about 1980, and the work itself is based on the ideas of the cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker, who in 1973 won a Pulitzer Prize for a book called The Denial of Death. And in that book, Becker argued that humans are unique in their awareness of the inevitability of death and that it can occur for any time for reasons that we could never anticipate or control. And what he argued is that we would literally be overwhelmed with paralyzing terror unless we could securely embed ourselves in what he called culture, humanly constructed beliefs about the nature of reality that we share with other people to provide us with a sense of meaning and value. And even immortality, either literally or symbolically. And my colleagues Jeff Greenberg and Tom Pazinski and I, along with other researchers around the world, have done literally hundreds of experiments that support Becker's ideas using a fairly simple paradigm where some people think about death and other people think about other things, either benign or unpleasant but not fatal. And then we ask them to make judgments about others who share or oppose their cherished beliefs. And so, for example, in one study, we asked Christian students to think about death or to think about watching television.
Okay.
And then we asked them to evaluate other students who were very similar except for being Jewish or Christian. And in the control condition, there was no difference in the evaluation of the targets as a function of their religion.
The control condition being those who were not introduced to death in particular, but just—
That's right, okay. Tom. But after a reminder of death, the Christian participants like their fellow Christians more, and Jewish people considerably less. And then other research has shown that after a reminder of death, people literally sit closer to those who share their beliefs and further away from those who are different. And when reminded of death, people are much more physically aggressive against those who do not share their political opinions.
Take us all the way back to one of your research studies published in 1989, where you talked with 22 municipal court judges in Tucson, Arizona, and saw how the mere mention death or reference to death really ratcheted up the kind of sentence they were prepared to hand down.
Well, that's one of our favorite studies, Tom, in the sense of being very powerful. We had access to a group of municipal court judges, and we had half of them think about death and the other half not. And then we gave them a court case that they were very familiar with. It was to set bond for an alleged prostitute, which was the most common crime in Tucson, Arizona at the time. Mm. And what we wanted to see is whether or not the bond that was set for the alleged prostitute would vary depending upon if the judges had thought about death beforehand. And we thought this was a particularly strong test because judges, after all, are trained to administer the law in a rational and even-handed fashion. And when we asked other judges before doing the study if thinking about death might influence how they would pass judgment, they were unequivocal in saying, no, that could never happen. And yet, in the control condition, the judges assigned an average bond of $50, which is typical for that infraction in Tucson.
That is, again, the judges who had not been reminded of death in the run-up to their decision. Yep.
Yep, I'm sorry, I'm degenerating into psychobabble, but the judges that were asked to think about death prior to rendering their decision, they assigned a bond of almost 10 times, $455.
In other words, they got very, very much tougher in the sentence they handed down. One of these references to death just asked that group of judges, as they thought about what penalty to lay down, to briefly describe the emotions that the thought of your own death arouses in you. So that was introduced just in a series of questions that came up to their sentencing here. So what's the conclusion? Does the thought of death drive the human mind or tend to in a particular direction? Does it push it toward a certain kind of response or thought or ratcheting up of reaction?
Well, Tom, that's a good question. What we found is that reminders of death tend to exaggerate one's affection for pre-existing cherished beliefs. And so if you believe that prostitution is bad, after being reminded of death, you'll be much more heavy-handed in your admonishment of people who engage in that crime. If you believe that your sports team, your favorite football team, is good, well, after a reminder of death, you'll take greater pleasure in one of their victories.
And what about, you also talk about the role of or responses to leaders and leadership after people are reminded of death.
Well, that's right, Tom. After the events of September 11th, which we argue, and perhaps not surprisingly, was a monumental and profoundly traumatic reminder of death, we began to wonder whether or not this might influence the political attitudes of Americans. One thing that we noticed was that prior to September 11th, 2001, that President Bush's approval rating was relatively low and dwindling. But just a few weeks later, the president enjoyed a historically unprecedented level of support by over 90% of the American public. And we got interested in this in part because the German sociologist Max Weber, at the beginning of the 20th century, argued that in times of psychological distress, people often become attracted to what he called charismatic leaders. And he defined those as folks who either claim or are imbued by their followers with divine ordination to rid the world of evil. And indeed, if you look at some of President Bush's declarations after September 11th, on the 17th of September, he declared war on terror as a crusade to rid the world of evil. And then in the cover story in Time magazine on October 22nd, he said he believed that God had chosen him to lead the country during this perilous time. And this struck us as very much like what Max Weber said in terms of charismatic leaders. And so we conducted a series of experiments starting in late 2002 to determine if some of President Bush's popularity and support for his policies in Iraq was influenced by Americans' concerns about death. And to do this, we asked some people to think about death and others to think about being in intense pain. And then a few minutes later, we asked them to rate their support for the president and his policies in Iraq. And what
and
we
outcome?
Found is the outcome was that people asked to think about pain were not especially supportive of the president or his policies in Iraq. But after thinking about death, the president was much more highly regarded, and his policies in Iraq were viewed more favorably.
You got even more specific in the run-up to the 2004 elections. February of that year, you went to students at Rutgers, undergraduate college students there, and asked them.
Well, that's right.
Give us a sense of that.
Well, we actually did two or three studies there, Tom, and we did one study, first of all, where we had three groups. We had one group that we asked to think about death. We had another group that we just asked to think about September 11th. And then we had a control group who, again, was just asked to think about pain. What we wanted to see in this study is whether thinking about September 11th for the average American is psychologically equivalent to thinking about dying. And sure enough, what we found is that reminders of 9/11 or reminders of death both increased support for the president and his policies in Iraq, and that this was true for liberal as well as conservative Americans. And
So when you look at the American psyche and politics since 9/11, as a psychologist, and we'll talk about whether or not you can keep your personal politics out of this. It must be difficult. But as a psychologist, what do you see? If 9/11 stands for death, what are the fingerprints of the psychological reaction on American policy since then? Can you make that kind of assessment?
Well, I think we can make very cautious assessments with regard to our studies that, yes, that September 11th, given the way that we think about it, has made Americans in a chronic state of what we call mortality salience, that just the relentless reference to the events of September 11th continue to be psychologically equivalent to thinking of oneself dying, and that this has very subtle but also very profound effects on the way that people think about themselves and the world around them.
Do you see those effects as negative, or do they lead us to a rational, heightened response to threat, to risk?
No, I see those as... I think that reminders of death can bring out both the very best and the very worst in us, but I don't see them, frankly, as bringing out anything rational. I think our studies would suggest that being reminded of death instigates a host of relatively unconscious defensive reactions.
We've been talking with Sheldon Solomon, professor of psychology at Skidmore College, co-author of In the Wake of 9/11. He's done a lot of research, well, long predating 9/11, into how the very mention or specter of death changes the way people think. We're joined as well right now from Rockport, Massachusetts, by Martha Stout. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice, served on the faculty in psychology at Harvard Medical School for 25 years. Her new book is The Paranoia Switch, How Terror Rewires Our Brains and Reshapes Our Behavior, and How We Can Reclaim Our Courage. Martha Stout, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, are you making the case that we've been out of our minds or since 9/11, or just in a misguided frame of mind, or would you go with those who said, you know, this was a wake-up call, we woke up, and now we're at the business of responding?
Well, I think there was some of both. Certainly at the very beginning, we started out being as Sheldon has just pointed out, we started out being generous and kind and so forth, but I believe that the trauma reaction took over. I've been seeing trauma therapists, individual ones, for more than 25 years, actually, and I began to notice that people were behaving like my trauma patients, and still are to a fair degree.
What do you mean by that?
That we are, in the most general sense, we're doing things that we wouldn't have done before, and we're allowing things, we're not doing other things that we would have done before, and we are just a great deal jumpier. People are still reporting nightmares and images in their brains, in their everyday existence that came from that event. That is sort of the paranoia switch, which is a play on words, the paranoia switch being what happened to our country, and also a thing that got instilled in our brains, that gets instilled in any trauma survivor's brain after 9/11.
What do you say to people who say, sometimes there are good reasons to be paranoid? For example, if an international terrorist organization is out to hit you.
Absolutely, there's sometimes good reason to be anxious, but you know, we've reached a level of anxiety which actually prevents us from behaving rationally. In psychology, there's something called the Yerkes-Dodson curve. If you can picture an upside-down U chart, what that means is that to a certain degree of fear, we get activated. We behave in some sense better or more efficiently than we were when we were not activated at all. But over that hump, our behavior decreases, or our competency decreases rapidly. And such that a little fear, some rational fear, if you will, is probably a good motivator. After that, it's counter-motivating down to what we refer to as tetany, which is not being able to behave at all.
Sheldon Solomon, do you make a judgment about whether or not the responses to the specter of death are positive or negative, good or bad? It changes the way people think. You've pretty well proven that. Do you make a value judgment about whether these are good or bad changes?
Well, yes and no. That's a good question, Tom. I agree with what Martha said there. They can be good and they can be bad. But one thing is clear, and that is that they're not at all rational. In fact, we have experimental evidence that suggests that when you ask people to behave or to think rationally, and then we ask them to think about death, that the effects that we normally get disappear.
The effects you normally get disappear. But I thought I thought death brought them on.
Well, it does bring them on, but that doesn't mean that there are other ways to counter them. So, for example, if we ask folks to think rationally and then remind them of their mortality and then have them make a judgment about another individual who might be different than them, we don't find the usual derogation of someone who's different that we would otherwise find when we remind people of mortality.
Martha Stout, you make the case, in effect, that the country's leadership has done just the opposite since 9/11, that it has pushed that button quite directly, and particularly when its interests were immediately on the line. You cite back in September 8th, 2004, just in the final run-up to the presidential election of that year, Vice President Dick Cheney in Des Moines, Iowa, saying, "It's absolutely essential that 8 weeks from today, on November 2nd, we make the right choice, because if we make the wrong choice, then the danger is we'll get hit again, and we'll be hit in a way that will be devastating from the standpoint of the United States." What's going on there, to your mind, as a psychologist, Martha Stout?
Well, you know, this is something that has become partisan, but in reality, politics as fear is extremely old, fear politics. It goes back as far as we've been together in collectives with leaders. I think, first of all, that it's just fascinating to me the way Sheldon's ideas and my own complement each other. It sort of points out to me that we get a double hit, that he's looking at fear as a strong motivator for us to have cultural reassurance that death is sort of taken care of in some way. I look at fear and how it affects the brain and memory at the level of the gray matter. And these are both profound changes, probably a part of the same change. And politics, you know, people who've been trying to influence people have used this, either knowingly or just kind of accidentally, for basically as long as human history spans. I think that if you look at some additional quotations from politicians on both sides, actually, since 2001, you find countless allusions to the notion that we should be afraid, we should be very afraid, and the way we can lessen our fear is by being loyal to this person or the other person. We like authoritarians when we're afraid. Human beings like that they are comforted by someone who will tell them that I know all the answers, I'm infallible, I will take care of you, and even you don't know what to do, so I will take care of you. Authoritarianism is very attractive to us when we're frightened.
Because we like it, or could it be that evolution has geared us, Sheldon Solomon, so we actually need it, that it gives cohesion at a time when otherwise we could all run around screaming?
I think that's very true. I think that there may be, of course, we'll never know, but there may very well be something to that. I know it's often been speculated that trauma reacts the way it does in the brain, or the brain reacts to trauma to try to protect us, to make sure we can keep behaving in the face of great trauma, that we don't just break down. Certainly as a function of society to keep us from being so afraid of death that we can't function. It's something that's adaptive. It is adaptive, but like so many things that have been adaptive eons ago, if it gets used in the modern world, it falls apart, like eating fat and sugar, which we used to, you know, we evolved in a situation where we should do that every time we saw fat or sugar.
Now too much, not so good. We're going to go in a moment to a national security expert to get his view on how our psychological response maybe have shaped, for better or worse, our response to the terrorism threat that made itself so plain on 9/11. Let me begin to bring our callers in first. Bill is calling from Brookline, New Hampshire. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I was listening. I just want to make an observation that the fear that I believe your guests are describing, in many ways, is very much short-lived, and that once, because people are responding to immediate reaction and making a decision, but I feel like that once people are actually have to deal with these actual issues on a day-to-day basis, for example, people who live in Iraq and deal with real fear, or people in London during the bombings, they had to move on with their daily lives when they were actually faced with real fear. But when we have only the specter of an attack,
or the memory,
that's when you have this psychological problem.
Absolutely.
Now that goes right to some of Sheldon Solomon's research. Bill, thank you very much for that, Professor Solomon. You looked at when fear has the greatest impact on people's thinking and response.
Agreed with Martha. It is, and the very excellent comments of the guest. For us, reminders of death have the greatest effect when they're relatively subtle or even non-conscious. When you see an airplane flying into a building, you are of course very afraid, and you know to run away. But the kinds of effects that we find, for example, the exaggerated enthusiasm for President Bush and his policies in Iraq, those are the result of very subtle reminders of death that unfold very often over time.
I want to bring a national security thinker into our conversation, if I may. Sheldon Solomon, Martha Stout, please stand by. Graham Allison joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's professor of government, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. He served as assistant secretary of defense some years ago. Graham Allison, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. A fascinating conversation.
What do you make of it? On the one hand, you're still out there ringing the bell for more attention to be paid to the threat of nuclear terrorism. On the other hand, we're hearing our psychologist guests say, you know what, too much fear of death can lead us in nonsensical directions or exaggerated directions. How do you look at the energy that comes out of that fear of death in the public as it pertains to security policy?
Well, I think you summarized it just right, that they're fascinating studies, and I think they certainly are, remind us of some well-established patterns of human psychology that are a part of, you know, the product of our evolution, in which attack sets off brain patterns and sets off the biochemical processes that are reflected in a psychology that then gravitates to, I mean, one of the sayings in international affairs is, when attacked, people rally behind the commander-in-chief. And then that's an independent, and sort of produces the energy, as you say, in the public. That's independent from two separate questions, which are, one, in reality, how serious is the threat? Is the response and the judgments about the danger irrational or paranoid, which it is sometimes, or indeed may it underestimate events? So that's one question. And the second question is, how appropriate is the response? If I rally behind the leader, he may end up doing the right thing. He may end up doing the wrong thing. I'm supporting him because I'm looking for somebody to protect me. Now, I would say in the answer to the first question, how serious is the threat? You look at pre-9/11, the U.S., simply most Americans, could not believe that somebody could attack the U.S. and kill 3,000 Americans. It was just inconceivable. We knew that terrible things happened elsewhere, but we thought almost we lived in a security bubble, like we lived on another planet. I would say that was hugely irrational. 9/11 reminded us that we live in a dangerous world, that you can pick up the paper every day and see horrible things happening, and that those things can happen right here on our own soil. So I would say that actually, you look at the July National Intelligence Estimate about the extent to which Al-Qaeda has reconstituted, the judgment publicly about whether there's serious danger of future terrorist attacks upon the U.S., including much more deadly terrorist attacks, even a nuclear terrorist attack, I do not think is exaggerated. That'd be my view in terms of the reality.
Now, Graham Allison, to go to the appropriateness of response, then, it's been a very big response.
I think it's been a big response, but I think it's been as misguided as it has been. There are many positives, but I would say that the net of it is negative, the biggest component of which is going to war on the wrong battlefield, that is Iraq. Nobody in Iraq attacked us on 9/11. Nobody in Iraq was planning to attack us on 9/11 or on the year after 9/11. So I think the president did absolutely the right thing in taking down al-Qaeda's sanctuaries in Afghanistan. We should have stuck with that and finished the job, but we didn't. We then went off on a misguided war, in my view, against a terrible tyrant, Saddam Hussein, but a person who was not connected with 9/11, who hadn't sponsored 9/11. We then, in effect, produced a rallying cry for the whole al-Qaeda narrative. So bin Laden, when we see him on this tape here, loves the idea that we were in Iraq, because that's exactly what he told his potential followers that we were going to do. We were going to attack an Arab country to try to steal its oil, and we were going to bog down there, and that's what he hoped it was going to happen.
Graham Allison, hold that thought for just a moment, if you'd be kind enough.
Yep.
Martha Stout, interesting. Let's just take the first part of this. Here's our security expert. He says, you know, yes, we were alarmed. Yes, we were fearful. But in some dimensions, we needed to be more alarmed, and we may be insufficiently alarmed even today. Are you prepared to go with that, or do you see if there were errors made, are they part and parcel of some kind of, being marinated too deeply in fear?
Well, you know, fear past a certain point makes us incompetent, makes us illogical. And I think that all three of us, in different ways, we're saying the same fundamental thing. We're talking about the difference between the unconscious and the conscious, the illogical and the logical. And I talk about this in the paranoia switch that psychologists in other countries, Israel, for example, Great Britain, have studied people's reactions after terrorism and have found that they don't react the way Americans did. The psychologists in Israel, for example, have noted that although there's an immediate reaction, of course, at the point of the terrorism, that the whole society does not then fall in need of psychiatric help or feel that it has been brutalized. And the difference, they say, is a realistic appraisal of what the threat is. And not just the threat to the country as a whole, but the threat to each individual. We, in the United States, really individualized that fear. We took it very personally.
Every household is a twin towers waiting to go.
Exactly. And that, you know, that's the point of terrorism, is to have you think that each terrorist attack has your name on it. Right after, you know, 9/11, 30% of us, all over the country, 30% of us believed that we would personally be killed by a terrorist attack or stood in danger of doing that. And that kind of over-the-top fear won't hear of rational explanations or statistics.
Let's go to our callers, if I may. We've got a call here from Israel, from Tel Aviv, Israel. Hanan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the political aspect of use of fear. I think Americans always were fearful. Talk about the Indians, the communists, et cetera, et cetera. There was always that fearful element in the background.
Mm.
And it's the same as us.
When you say us, you mean Israelis?
Same as us Israelis, yes. And I think the use is... It's semi-conscious use for political reasons. We're both immigrant societies, and you need this common element to pull the people together.
So is the fear useful or abused or both?
In my view, it's abused. It's greatly abused. I think you can find more more creative ways to bring the people together. Fear is always the easy one, the easy way out.
And you say that even in Israel, a much smaller chip of land than the USA.
Yes, I do.
Well, Anand, thanks very much for listening in Tel Aviv, and thanks for calling in. Let's get a call from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Sonia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to mention that I think that, in a sense, the way we've responded to the terrorist attack, we've already lost, or they've won, because we've spent money and time on things that we wouldn't normally do.
But maybe we needed to pump up our defenses and our vigilance with that kind of threat. I mean, that wasn't patty cake.
3,000 people died on 9/11, or something like that number.
Mm-hmm.
And in that year, 42,000 died in car accidents. And there was, we're creating enemies by our behavior, as your previous guest said. And there are better things to do with our time and money, I think.
Sonia, thanks very much for that. Sheldon Solomon, in some way, your research would say yes, because in the absence of the threat of death, we are almost always likely to think differently. Does that mean we thought incorrectly because of that towering image of death?
Well, again, I guess yes and no. I like the way that Graham put it when he said that the threat is a very real one, and I think it would behoove us to attend to that. On the other hand, I think where the real questions arise is to how effectively our leadership and us as United States citizens have responded constructively to those threats. And I think here is where we fall way short. The way that we think about it, or like to think about it, is that there's a big difference between feeling safe and actually being safe. And I think a case could be made that what President Bush has done for many Americans is to make them feel safe. But I think at the same time, a case could be made that in reality, we're substantially less safe than we were in 2001. I would urge every American to read the 9/11 Commission report and to look at the annual report card by the 9/11 Commission documenting progress towards making us genuinely safer, and even the report of the Iraq Study Group. I think the best thing that we could do right now as citizens is to educate ourselves as much as possible.
You know, you've got a lot of people, Dr. Solomon, who, you certainly have a loud chorus who say, thank heavens we've gone to war, there was a big threat here. You know, do you ever worry about your personal politics driving your psychological research? Is that possible? I mean, you know, are these research findings just confirming a political prejudice of your own?
I hope not. Like all scientists, we're human. And I think whether we like it or not, that the kind of people that we are influence the questions that we often ask or the ones that we decline to ask, and we should acknowledge that. On the other hand, we should also note that there are rigorous safeguards in place in science that reduce the probability that pre-existing attitudes can influence the outcome of psychological research. Our participants in our studies are randomly assigned to conditions. We don't know whether they've been asked to think about dying or something else, and the data are scored and checked by other individuals. So while a case might be made that the questions are somewhat skewed by the predilections of the researchers, I'd like to think that the outcomes are not. And every one of the studies that I talked about today has been replicated more than once in different locations.
Let's go to Joe in Fort Dodge, Iowa. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering, it's a fascinating topic. Is there a difference in the European reaction to terrorism versus the American, just from the standpoint of, well, I worked in Europe for a year, and I was within a block or hours of two terrorist bomb attacks while I was working, and we just never have had that kind of experience in the United States. And then all of a sudden, we have 3,000-plus people killed in what really is sort of the first terrorist attack in the United States. I'd just like the researchers to comment, and you know, I can take the answers off air. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Joe. Graham Allison, how about it? You watch Europe as well as the United States. Do you see a different psychological response, a different policy response that might grow from it?
Yes, I think it's a very good question, and I think that the different histories help us understand the different psychologies of reaction. The Europeans have been accustomed to terrorist attacks over, you know, the last, even you can go back to the terrorist attacks that brought on World War One, but in more recent period, the Red Brigades, the Biedermannhof group in mm-hmm. Germany, so the Irish in London, so people got used to the notion of onesies and twosies, even 10 or 20 people being killed. Americans, as I say, had this almost psychological bubble where just nothing terrible happened here very much. Now, actually, that's not true. Yosef and Al-Qaeda early on attacked the World Trade Center in 1993. We had in the Oklahoma City homegrown American terrorists, mm-hmm. but mostly it wasn't part of our psychology. And then it came with this huge big bang, and it wasn't just 3,000 people. I think this is where the studies that you've Sheldon and Martha have done are very helpful. For bin Laden, he's into killing massively, but in a spectacular fashion. And in the tape that he did after 9/11, he even helped you could understand a little bit more of the way he thinks of it, almost as theater. And this was beyond, he said it was beyond his expectations, because people got on video these images of airplanes flying into big buildings. And then it was played over and over and over, so it happened over and over. One of the children of a good friend of mine in New York kept asking her father, why do they keep doing this over and over and over? She was 5 years old, but she was thinking that every day this was happening again, or that it was happening multiple times. And I think that imagery, since all human or most Americans, you know, fly in airplanes or visit big buildings, kind of had a picture of it. So I think I think our reaction has been, understandably for our history, a little floundering. Like, gee, they're not supposed to do that to us. You know, it's okay if Irish blow up a trash can or something in Europe, and if something terrible happens in Israel or in Palestine, but not here. And I think the way that that's at least discussed in the national security community is whether the population becomes resilient or sophisticated enough to deal with the notion. Because there's no question at the individual level, if you take the variations in psychology that that Martha and Sheldon have been talking about, mm-hmm. When people estimate the likelihood that they will be the subject of a terrorist attack relative to the danger of flying on an airplane or riding in their car to the airport, they get the numbers entirely haywire, or some of them, mm-hmm. a substantial number do. Mm-hmm. So after 9/11, quite a number of people thought, gee, I'm likely to be in the city, in the building, or in the airplane in which such an event happens, even though statistically there's a very low probability that any individual would be the victim of a terrorist.
Let me go to you, Martha Stout, on this on the issue of different kinds of responses, Europe's response, America's. I heard former UN Ambassador John Bolton on the BBC today saying that, you know, the good thing out of this is that we've gone to war against terrorism and we need Europe to get on board. So, I mean, psychology and politics and policy are still very tightly wrapped here. He's going the opposite way. He's celebrating and saying that, you know, we've had a strong response to this, and we need Europe to respond more like us. You write in your book, The Paranoia Switch, about what you call fear brokers, those who manipulate, capitalize on fear. How do you distinguish between a fear broker and a good leader in a time of danger?
Well, I can't say that I'm surprised that Mr. Bolton made such a comment. And, of course, there is a difference between the way Europeans and Israelis and so forth respond at this point to terror.
But do you doubt that he means it? I mean, he's been fairly consistent.
I don't know. I have no way of knowing. It could be that he means it. It could be that he's being opportunist. And I think that's true of any leader or politician, that the fear reactions that get used. And this has been true throughout human history. you know, this is not just now. The fear reactions that get used, sometimes they get used by leaders who are genuinely concerned, and sometimes they get just plain used. And I think we can't, we don't want to overlook how much our reaction, as opposed to the Europeans and the Israelis, how much of it was affected by what we were told and shown and directed to do, beginning pretty much right after the attack. I call this syndrome a limbic war, which is basically a leader taking the opportunity of human fear to wage a kind of war against his own people. It's happened throughout history, and even as young as we are as a nation, it's happened to us several times. Happened during McCarthyism, happened right after Pearl Harbor, which is somewhat analogous to 9/11 and its social effects.
So is FDR a fear broker as well?
FDR, perhaps not in particular, but what one of the interesting things that, and there are several analogies actually, one of the interesting things that happened right after Pearl Harbor is that the Secretary of the Navy became concerned that the Navy was going to lose face because of what happened, that they were going to be accused of not having been guardful enough and or protected the people enough.
But I want to go, our time is short, I want to go to the bigger point. Are you saying, it almost sounds as though there's no threat then that would, in your view, would rightly trigger a war response? I mean, FDR was saying something bigger than the Navy will lose face. He was saying our national life is at risk here.
I think, again, we look at the difference between the threat to the nation and the threat to the individual, and then we look very, very hard at the effects of fear. You know, is the fear and the paranoia, is it making us be vigilant and do the things that we need to do to protect ourselves? And clearly we do need to protect ourselves. We need to guard our food supplies and our nuclear plants and so on. We definitely need to do that. And we need to do that in a clear-headed, rational way, rather than a fearful way, which would cause us to adhere to the strongest authoritarian leader who comes around.
Sheldon, your research suggests that it's not just security policy that's affected by the specter of death. As you said, people cling more tightly to all kinds of core cultural assumptions or beliefs. Like what? What's the evidence that you might have seen of that since 9/11?
Well, again, I would agree with what you just said. With regard to the U.S. versus Europe, I just want to add what I think is an important point, and that's the targets of the September 11th attack, that the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, besides the obvious damage, are just symbols of unparalleled American economic and military might, respectively. And I think it's the symbolic death of these buildings that helps us account for Americans' response to this tragedy. It'd be like if in Europe Buckingham Palace or the Eiffel Tower had been obliterated, which I guess, again, brings me back to Graham's point. I think that we had to do something. This is a genuine threat, but we're fighting the wrong war in Iraq right now.
And is that a psychologist's assessment or a citizen political assessment?
No, I think that's what I'd like to think is the assessment of an informed citizen. As a psychologist, again, my point would be that it's incumbent upon all of us to render ourselves as informed as possible. And so, for example, I think it's unfortunate that today and tomorrow, particularly tomorrow, is the day that General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker will testify in front of Congress. I think that 9/11 is the worst day imaginable to convey information in the hopes of rationally and dispassionately evaluating it. I think it's very likely that anything that's said tomorrow will be provide exaggerated support for the president and his policies in Iraq. But that wasn't the stated intent of waiting until we had wisdom from the military community.
Mm-hmm. Graham Allison, last word goes to you today. Tomorrow's 9/11. There will be that testimony. People could take away from this conversation that it's time to kind of settle down and simmer down. On the other hand, you continue to warn about terrorist threats, nuclear terror threats, for example. So as a national security guy, we've just got half a minute here. Do you want more fear or less?
Well, I certainly hadn't thought of this connection between 9/11 and the Petraeus testimony, and I think Sheldon's point's right about that. I would say that it's right to sober up after 9/11. And a sober assessment would say we faced extremely dangerous environment, but that didn't lead us, it shouldn't lead us to go strike out at anybody. It should lead us to focus on the enemy that needs to be, eliminated, and the dangers, the specific dangers like nuclear terrorism that pose the greatest threat to the country.
Graham, with that, we're out of time today. Graham Allison, author of Nuclear Terrorism, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Martha Stout, author of The Paranoia Switch, thanks for being here, Martha.
Thank you.
And Sheldon Solomon at Skidmore College, thank you, Professor Solomon.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.